And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Bob from Alpine.
I'm Bob and I'm alcoholic. Wow, this is very powerful. And some years, 17 years ago, I never thought that I'd be standing in front of a lot of people like this and doing any public speaking, that's for sure. I've had an interesting day today. This anxiety going on inside, and this is going to be good for me because I know you people are here to support me tonight, and I'm certainly here to support you. I just hope that I don't bore you to death. I want to thank those that asked me to come and speak here tonight because I've only done this once or twice, and over this period of time, I should feel more comfortable, I feel, inside, but I don't. And so with that admission, I'd like to get started with just kind of touching on some of the things that happened to me when I was a youngster. I was adopted, only child, became a ward of the state in Colorado, and my mother gave me up when she had me. And I was adopted into a family that was just a mother and father, and God bless them for doing what they did. I don't know where I'd be today. However, I was reunited with my birth mother, and that took place when I was 55 years old, and I'm 63 now. She's since passed away, but she was not alcoholic, it didn't seem like, and I have two half-brothers, and they don't appear to be alcoholic either. And I'm not sure. A lot of people speculate that alcoholism is inherited, and others say that it's because we drank our way into alcoholism. And I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I never will be, but it doesn't matter. What matters is that I was a daily drinker near the end, and I drank about a pint a day on an average, and then quite a few beers on top of that. But my mother was alcoholic, the one that adopted me, and I can't remember when she didn't have her medicine in the cabinet in the kitchen. And she would take that medicine and it would change her whole personality. And as I watched the changes taking place, I got a lot of mixed messages. And as I grew up, I said, I don't want to be that way. And my parents used to really fight it out. And I could tell my father's name was Harry and my mother's name was Irene. And when my dad was a strict disciplinarian and he was a teetotaler, basically, and what he did is he would get in this argument. It was almost always about her drinking over and over and over again. And when the argument would start heating up, as soon as he went from calling her sweetheart to Irene, it was time for me to go to the bedroom. That's where it worked out the best for me. And so I got out of there and went in the bedroom, and wished I wasn't in those circumstances a lot of times, but overall I got a pretty good break. I didn't start drinking until I was 15, and when I was 15 I went to work in a little resort area in Colorado for a summer job, and when I was there, the kids were 18, and they were going to the local bars, and they were drinking 3-2 beer, and so I asked them if they'd get me some, and they brought it back, and I think there was 3 beers, maybe 2, but I drank one with them, paid for it, and then the next drink that I had by myself, because they all went home. So that was an indication right there that I had the potential for being alcoholic and didn't know it. And in retrospect, I didn't know, I just didn't know that by drinking by yourself that was important. I do remember having one foot on the floor and one foot laying on the bed and a foot on the floor trying to keep the room from going around, and I really thought that I probably was going to get sick, but I didn't, so I don't know how that played out. The next time I drank was almost 2 years later, as I recall, and I had moved to Manhattan Beach, California. And the second drinking experience that I had was the one that really set in my mind that I really liked alcohol a lot. It was really my... I knew it was going to be a big, big part of my future, and that I was going to be able to use this and rely on it as a coping mechanism and everything for my shyness, not feeling up to being as good as other people, and things I think that I might have gotten conditioned to in my growing up. I'm not absolutely sure, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, a couple of friends of mine, we sat out in a parking lot in a church in Hermosa Beach, and we got some malt liquor and some Seagram 7, and we proceeded to get pretty ripped up. And we went over to the Torrance Community Center, and the Beach Boys were brand new then, and I was the night I learned to dance. I had taken I'd taken a lot of dance lessons because my mother thought that that was a good idea, and she needed a dance partner, I guess, while my dad was out of town. But anyway, I took up about a quarter of the dance floor, and I never had felt like that before in my life. It was the best feeling I ever had. I said, "My God, this is wonderful!" And then from there we went down to the Torrance Beach, and we rolled down the hillside and through the ice plant and everything else. And then I went home, and my dad was up. And wasn't he surprised? Here I was, really a mess. And I remember he had a tendency to get pretty angry about stuff and could get physical, and I could see it coming. And it was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I cried. I started crying, and I said, "It's tough being a teenager." And you know what? He bought it. I said, "Okay." And I didn't get the whipping that I thought I was going to get. My biggest problem, it seemed like, in growing up and that not feeling like I was quite good enough and up to standard, was that part of that overlay on that was that I couldn't make decisions on what I wanted to do as far as a career. And so my father sort of gave me a choice. He was an airline pilot, and he said to me, "If you'd like to be an airline pilot, that's something you might shoot for, and I'll pay for your flying lessons, or I'll send you to college if you want to go to college." And I had soloed a light airplane at the Hawthorne Airport, and it scared me. I really didn't care for it. And so I took the college route, and I went to junior college, and I took engineering. And I didn't know what I wanted to take. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I don't know if anybody in this room has ever felt that way. They had no direction. So he said, "Well, let's get the one ads out and see where the jobs are." And he did. He opened up the page, and we started looking at engineer jobs. And he said, "How about being an engineer? There's lots of engineer positions." This was in about 1962. And I decided, well, okay, engineering it'll be then. So I started taking engineering classes, and, man, they were hard. I mean, this was not easy. So not being the sharpest tool in the shed, I decided that maybe I needed to change my course correction here and try flying. So I went to... I went to Ardmore, Oklahoma, and I went to a flight school down there, and I went straight to a commercial pilot's license, and I got that. And by this time now, the drinking had picked up a little bit, and there was a lot of partying going on, and I got that commercial license and picked up a couple other ratings after that that allowed me to be an instructor. So I dodged the military, and I became a flight instructor, and I taught for a year and a half, and then I... started applying for airline jobs, and I had my father actually was filling out my applications for me. He was ready for me to get the hell out of the house. And so he was helping me with that, and I guess I was a pretty spoiled kid, but I got hired by a couple airlines, and I went there, and when I started out there, I had the choice of either Western or TWA, and I took TWA because I had a roommate. You know, I was always going with what anybody else thought. I had a roommate that flew for TWA, and he said, "Well, why don't you come over here? You want to fly for them, not Western, do you? You don't want to go to Boise. You want to go to Paris." I said, "Oh, yeah." And I'd seen this movie, and the movie was New York on Sunday, or Sunday in New York, or something. And boy, that impressed me. I said, "That's the kind of guy I want to be. You know, I want to be just like him." And I was pretty much like him, except he didn't drink, and I did. And the movie. So anyway, I went to work at the airline, and I really cooled it for the first year, year and a half. I was on a probationary period, and I knew that I could, you know, miss the mark a little bit. So I really backed off of my drinking a lot. I thought it'd be in my best interest to do that. And I watched closely what others were doing around me, and I noticed that some of the supervisors would like to drink too. And so when I was on a trip, I would sometimes I would go with them out and have drinks, but it finally got to the point where on the layovers that I found myself drinking by myself in bars where I probably shouldn't have been, the lesser companionship part that we hear about, and it felt comfortable doing that, and they didn't drink like I did. So, and I was always I was a good control drinker. I just would pretty much hit it on the head. I could drink and get pretty drunk and enjoy myself, and then you know, sleep it off, get up in the morning, walk around the block in the hotel a few times, put some Visine in my eyes, put a lot of Gargle down, and go get in the crew bus and sit up in the front on the right hand side where nobody could smell me. And I thought I was pulling it off, and I did. Pulled it off for years. I did 25 years that way. And there were others. We knew who we were, and we hung around together. And, you know, they finally got wise, though, and they said, we're going to get a cross-check on your driver's licenses, and that way we can find out if any of these people that are pilots have drinking problems with their DUIs. And so they gave amnesty to everyone that may not have reported a DUI previously. And I had a lawyer write a letter, which helped me in that first DUI that I got. My first DUI was terrifying, and I thought I was going to be exposed, and I slipped through some way. I just got through that. And I went along then after that period of time. My daughter here came along shortly after that, and her mother and I, her mother thought I was probably an alcoholic, and when she came along, she was premature, and you know, I felt a tremendous amount of pressure, and her mom wanted to quit her position at the airline as a flight attendant, and so we agreed that that would be in her best interest, and we did that, and then I had this financial thing over my head, thinking I wasn't going to be able to afford to do this. And, you know, the pressure was mounting. The DUI thing was an issue, and I just quit drinking. I went 9 months without a drink. And in that 9 months, I thought about it all the time. It's all I could do is think about drinking. Think. And I remember going to New Year's Eve dinner with some people, and they were all having champagne, and I was just drinking like 7-Up or something, and it was miserable. I mean, I can't think of anything I didn't like. So when this control and enjoy your drinking was a real deal with me. I couldn't do both of them at the same time. And anyway, I continued to progress. I actually went from I guess I went for 22 years drinking like that in a row from the time I was 17 to 39. And before I got that first DUI, I had to make some notes here. I have to retrace everything I've ever done. I had to do it according to, you know, my memory isn't all that great. And I really cannot remember a lot of stuff. And there was a lot of blackouts. There was bizarre behaviors and blackouts, and there was a couple of accidents, and there was... ended up finding myself floating out in the harbor in Long Beach in my 40-foot boat at 3 o'clock in the morning after the bars had closed with a dead engine and no electrical. And that's where the big ships go through there. I was by myself, and that was the night that my Eskimo came along in a little tiny raft with about a 2-horsepower Seagull engine or something and pulled me back to the dock where I spent the night, horrified at what potential could have happened there. I got away with it again. I slipped through the crack again. And then another incident. I'm not going to make this drunk log too long, but I do want to say another incident of mine that was really quite surprising. As I was coming home from a party up in Hollywood, and I had a 911S, and I was on the freeway, and I was having a little bit of dozing off, and the next thing I knew, I was going through the ice plant, and it was coming like this, and I was going down an embankment, and ended up at the bottom of the embankment, and I could smell gasoline. Well, I had woke up a little by now, and I drove to my apartment down in Torrance, and I parked several blocks away because this thing was obviously punctured a hole in the gas tank. And I parked 2 or 3 blocks away, and went up and crashed. And next thing I know, there's a knock on the door, and it's the police. And they said, "Do you own a 911S or blue one?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he says, "Do you know that it's leaking fuel all over the street?" And I said, "No, I didn't know that." "How do you suppose that happened?" He said, "Why are you parked 3 blocks away?" And I don't know where this came from, but I came up with a great lie just like that. I said, "Oh, well, they were having a party around here, and there was no place to park. Somebody had my parking spot." So, well, he said, "You better get right on that." So I slipped through the cracks again. I began to get this, along with 2 failed marriages to this point now, I had this feeling of impending doom. I knew something bad was going to happen to me. I was going to really get in trouble somewhere. And it was surprising how that consumed me. And it kept me in a low-grade anxiety. I was in a position of just feeling like my hands were sweating all the time. And it was not a pleasant place to be. Anyway, I had gone to Nebraska with a girlfriend at the time, and we went back there to hunt pheasants, and that was 17 years ago. And about right now, we'd be back there 17 years ago, and it was her first hunting experience, and she got a bird, and we started to drive back, and we got to Grand Junction. We spent the night there. And then the next morning, I wanted to hightail it for San Diego. So I drove all the way here. And that's a long drive from Grand Junction to here. And when I got here, we had a couple of drinks in my place. And then she went home to her kids, and I decided to go out. So I was going to go find a new place that was going to be a lot of fun. And I went over to Lemon Grove and got completely lost. Went into a liquor store and asked how I could get back on the freeway, you know, find my way back where I was. And I was pretty darn drunk. I had a couple of drinks on the way over there. And the next thing I knew is I was frustrated because I couldn't remember the instructions that he had given me on how to get there. I had a high-performance Taurus SHO, and I spun the tires going out of the parking lot, and on come the lights. And I knew then the jig was up. That was going to be the end of it. And I knew I had a choice then. I would either have to quit flying and drink myself to death, or, you know, didn't know it would be that serious, but that's ultimately probably what would have happened. Or I had to get sober. So the airlines had, and the FAA had a very good program for guys like me. And I got sober. I was able to get an opportunity to go to Betty Ford, and went to aftercare. And for 2 years, I was on a monitored program, and the monitored program was pretty restrictive. They had me on a short leash, and, you know, it was just what I needed, and it was enough to get a good foundation. And that's the point I want to make here, is that a good foundation was very helpful for me, and that foundation has followed me through, and I haven't had a relapse up to now. I hope I don't ever have a relapse. I'm in it for life, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I remember going to the first meeting. This meeting, somebody before the meeting was telling me outside out here, they said, "This reminds me of the old Saturday night speakers over in El Cajon." And that was the very first meeting I went to. And what a meeting that was. I was asked to sit right in front, and I sat up, and the speaker was guy short in stature with a three-piece suit that was sort of a leisure suit thing, you know, it was a brown. And he had a little gold pendant that he was wearing up here, and it had the number 17, and then under it said even. And I kept thinking, what the heck is that? And at the end of his pitch or talk, he said, you might wonder what this is. He said, recently, he said, I went and I told my sponsor that I was concerned. My wife, I'm sure, keeps thinking that I'm going to go out and relapse, and I've been sober for 10 years. And the sponsor said, well, the question is, how long did you drink in front of your wife? And he said, 17 years. And he says, well, when you get 17 years, you'll be even. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty heavy little, that's heavy stuff. Where does that come from? One of my drinking experiences that I had was with a friend of mine, and I was agnostic when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't say I was an atheist because my understanding of an atheist is or an agnostic is a chicken shit atheist, really. It doesn't want to. We were drinking beer, and we got on the subject of religion, which made me really nervous. Man, I get around church, and I didn't like it. And I said, what religion are you, Don? And Don says, well, my tabernacle's in my own heart. I said, boy, that's pretty cool. And I thought about that. I thought, that's a way to shine people off. If they ask me what religion I am, I just shine on. And so I used that. And, you know, 17 years later, or longer, way longer than 17 years later, way longer, like, I got 40 years here. 40 years later, my tabernacle's in my own heart. That's where it is today. And, you know, I look for, I don't know about anyone here, and I can just tell you my story is that I have always had questions in my mind that there was a higher power until I began to see the things that were called coincidences happening around me that were just too bizarre to possibly be just a coincidence. You know, these things are so powerful. And the one that I recall recently that really shook my whole life was that I sponsored a friend of mine that had a cabin in Mexico next to mine. And we were old drinking buddies. And he had almost 2 years sober and quit going to meetings. And I was concerned, so I called him after a couple, two or three weeks, and he hadn't been feeling too good, and his ex-wife had told me that he was in the hospital and that he had cancer throughout and that he was going down fast, and you better go see him if you want to see him. And so I went over on a Saturday, and I think that was around February the 3rd this year, and I saw him in the hospital, and I've never seen anybody that sick, and he was on oxygen, and his eyes were rolling around and everything. And his son that I hadn't met before told me that Jim can hear you if you speak loud enough. He'll respond. And so I asked him, I said, Jim, can you hear me? And he said, yeah, I can. And he didn't say anything. And I knew he could hear me. I could feel it. And his family was there. There was a preacher there and his wife. And I told Jim, I don't know where it came from, but I just told him, I said, you know, God won't give you more than you can handle. And he died that night at 7 o'clock. And within about a week to 10 days before he had any kind of a service, I was on my motorcycle with a friend and had gone out to Agua Caliente and to the spa out there. And we were sitting in the spa, and there's about 20 people in there. And we, just the two of us, were talking, and the next thing I know is this guy's asking me, he says, are they cleaning the spa at noon? And all the other people had left except for this one couple. And I said, not to my knowledge that they don't do that. And he said, well, where'd everybody go? And I said, I don't know. And He said, but started talking about how much he liked it out there. He said, I spent the night out here with my girlfriend last night. He said, we slept in the back of the truck, away from the vapor condenser lights or whatever. And he said, we were looking at the stars, and really a powerful, powerful feeling. He says, it's like when I'm down in Baja, California, you know, I get that same feeling down there. And I said, oh, where is that? And he said, south of San Felipe. And I said, oh, I said, I have a little cabin down there, south of Puerto Cetus, and it's at El Huerfanito. And he said, oh, well, maybe you know of one of my best friends, a guy that I hired to work at Sears for 40 years. And his name is Jim Prado. And I said, yes, I know Jim. He's my next door neighbor. And he did you know that he died just over a week ago? And he said, no. And I said, did you know that Jim had a drinking problem? He said, oh, yeah, we used to drink like crazy, you know. And I said, well, he got sober, and he stayed sober for about 2 years. And I said, I was able to be a part of that. And he said, no kidding. And he said, Mary, Jim got sober and he died. He then went on to say that he had quit drinking himself in August. And I said, do you go to AA to do that? What do you use as a substitute? And he said, well, he said, I promote Dixieland jazz and stuff in the South, in Southern California. And I said, have you ever thought of going to AA? And he said, no, not really. I don't think I need to do that. I said, well, if you ever want to stay sober and really make it work for you, you might think about it. Because do you feel a connection between you and I? And he said, yeah. I said, there's millions of people like us that are out there that are getting sober. And it's a miracle, you know. And anyway, I was able to tell him about, just briefly, about a service that was held for Jim. And give him a number so he could get in touch with the family. But let me tell you, the way I look at it is that the odds of that happening, for me to be in that spot, 65 miles or so out east of San Diego, and I came from Alpine and they were from Escondido, and to meet in that environment, to have those people get up and leave that pool and have him start asking me questions, and one thing led to another, that's some kind of a predestined thing to me. That is not by chance, or that's by design of some form. That is my proof that there's a higher power. And I really believe it. And that would be a one chance in 5 million, maybe. Maybe more, I don't know. But it was enough to really convince me that there's something that really is going on. And it's only one of the situations that I feel strongly about that does connect me with a higher power that I don't particularly really understand that much. But I know it's working for me because I haven't had a drink in a long time. And my life is good. And I was going to read something out of this book, but I don't think I will now. The time is almost running out. And anyway, I just wanted to touch on the fact that as every year that I stay sober, my life gets better. And, you know, you people are the ones that bring that to me, along with that higher power. You are the folks that came out tonight to watch me. This was my night to stand up here. And I didn't really want to do this. You know, I don't like to be in the center of attraction or attention. There's something inherently a little bit flawed inside of me that keeps telling me I'm still not good enough, still not quite there. And you know what? You guys are here to support me. I heard that at Battery Charger somebody shared the other day, that all the people in this room at Battery Chargers are here to support me. And, you know, that's a nice way for me to look at it today, because if I keep that in mind, I realize what a real support system I have is better than anything I could possibly have anywhere else. And, you know, I think sometimes when I leave my place in the morning at about 6 o'clock, a lot of times, it's never later than 7, and Monday through Friday, and I'm retired, and I'm just waiting for my neighbor to say, where do you go every morning? And I'm going to say, I go to a birthday party. every morning I go to birthday party. And what a great deal that is. And I heard also something that I thought was neat, and that is in Alcoholics Anonymous, we introduce ourselves as alcoholics, and we get applauded for it. And then we get cake for saving our lives. You know? Not too bad. And I'm going to close with this, and I went up to this higher power thing. To me, is really, really paramount. I went up to Palomar recently, and I went to the observatory, and I wanted to try and get a grasp of the size of our universe. And so I picked these numbers that light travels at 186,000 miles per second, and over a year's period, that's 7 trillion miles that light travels. And I was talking to a lady up there that was talking about the Hale telescope. And she said this telescope looks out 13 billion light years to the light source. And that's as far as they know. Now, according to her, that's as far as they know. According to the Big Bang theory, how big our universe is. But that number comes out to 78 to the 21st power. So there's 21 zeros behind that. I don't even know what that number would be. But to try to grasp the magnitude of that is unbelievable. And that telescope now is going to be dwarfed by a new one that they're building that will be at one of three sites. And it will be 6 times more powerful. So we'll know more, maybe in our lifetimes, or some of you might. And God bless us all. I'm glad I was here. Thank you very much for letting me speak. I hope I didn't bore you to death. I had a good time in retrospect. Thank you so much.